Greetings, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea. This is Ian Punnett, Coast to Coast AM, and to the hostile, invading alien armies hovering silently behind their cloaking devices just outside of Earth's atmosphere. Remember, eat the Canadians first. We have seen a huge uptick in interest in UAPs since the Pentagon's reclassification of UFOs to UAPs. It's a hot topic right now. I get invited onto podcasts or other radio shows for three reasons. Either my work here on Coast to Coast, which is always fun. My expertise in the true crime genre, having written my dissertation on the subject, and or leadership, like particularly within a religious context. It is in that last space I want to quickly mention a follow-up from last night's open lines on Coast to Coast after we were talking to the doctor who had been working for years on his theory that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was actually Jack the Ripper. Fun book, as sad as it was, The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle, A Journey into Madness and Mayhem, really lands some blows, I think. But when we got to the open line segment, we were talking about a couple of different things, UAPs among them, and somebody brought up the subject of unicorns in the King James Version of the Bible. And I drew a total blank on that because I don't read the KJV. I haven't spent any time with it in probably 40 years. Every bit of my scholarship I try to do is either in the original Hebrew or Greek, and then working with rabbis and other people on the nuances of some of the language. But she brought up the fact that in the King James Version of the Bible, it mentions unicorns. And I thought, well, I said, if that's true, and I really couldn't tell if she was pulling my leg or not, because I remember, I think everybody does, that there were green alligators and long-necked geese and humpback camels and chimpanzees, you know, and but there were no unicorns in the Ark. And so we were kind of thinking about that last night, and I promised as soon as I got off the air that I would look it up, because I've always, usually is the case with the King James Version, it's kind of a paraphrase. It's not a very good translation of the Bible on either in the Hebrew Bible or in the Christian New Testament. And in fact, as I suspected and as I told her last night, I thought, this was probably going to be one of those 17th century, you know, scholarship scribal errors that they really didn't know what the word meant, what the Hebrew word meant. So they just kind of filled in a best guess. And they put unicorns in for what is otherwise translated as wild oxen. There's the thought that the word really translates to horned beast. And that could mean theoretically one-horned, but more likely two-horned, and it's wild oxen everywhere else. So I just thought I'd make that clear, since that was one of the loose ends from last night. I don't think we're going to have any from tonight. In fact, I'm so excited to have on our first guest, Josh Zeman. I'll tell you more about him and his work in just a moment, but also our main guest next hour, the researcher into raptors, and particularly prehistoric connections between the species that we have today and what would have existed in the age of the dinosaurs. That there are dinosaurs that are flying and walking amongst us. A Most Remarkable Creature is the name of the book, The Hidden Life and Epic Journey of the World's Smartest Birds of Prey. That starts next hour, but first, we'll go back to the Summer of Sam and this amazing Netflix documentary about the sons of Sam, intentionally plural, and the story of the man who proved it, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Joshua Zeman, I don't have to tell you that you did it again. It's a great piece that you've come up with here that's running on Netflix and getting me a ton of interest on Twitter as people are saying, you got to see this. And I'm like, not only see it, we've got the director scheduled. So thank you for agreeing to be with us here on Coast to Coast.
Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
Not a surprise you're the same guy who did Cropsy.
That's right.
That was cool. And that was a complete surprise. I mean, for me anyway, I didn't know what to expect. I liked the graphic. I liked the photo. I clicked onto it. I thought I'd give it some time. Really enjoyed your mediation of it, your narration, and the personalization you brought to the story of Cropsy. And then that weird left turn that it takes somewhere in the middle, which in a lot of ways, it takes another left turn and brings us to Sons of Sam, A Descent into Darkness, which is currently in the top 10 of all things being watched on Netflix.
Yeah, we've been, this has been an amazing response to the series. So we're really happy about that.
But the connection had to have come when you were researching Cropsy, because it just seems like those two things dovetail too nicely to be a coincidence that you did Sons of Sam after you did Cropsy.
So Cropsy basically, as you some of your viewers might know, is about some five missing kids in my hometown of Staten Island, New York. And while we were doing that documentary and researching, we kept hearing rumors going around Staten Island about these kids were somehow connected to a cult, and a cult that was theoretically behind the Son of Sam. And growing up in Staten Island in New York, I had known all about the Son of Sam. I had no idea that it could be connected to my case. I actually thought that all these rumors were just satanic panic. But a couple of the cops sat me down and they said, no, actually, there's a real connection here. And let me tell you a story. And they started by saying, you have to read this book, The Ultimate Evil, written by Maury Terry. And I read the book and it scared the crap out of me. And from that, I met Maury Terry and he proceeded to tell me about the Son of Sam and how the Son of Sam didn't act alone. And that basically started this journey, 10 years, 12 years in the making.
Yeah, it's worth every second of the research that you put into it. I'm not going to give it away, but I absolutely loved the ending, the final ending. That was such a left hook. I thought it was great. It was, and I thought in a way, I was like, well, this is nice. He's winding it down with a little denouement. And then suddenly, boom. So I thought everything about it, you can't hate a documentary about 1970s New York to begin with, because it was such a crummy place in so many ways, and the fashions were awful, and the hair was terrible, and oh, gosh. And it was that in itself was worth the price of a ticket, because you just kind of go back in, and you're like, remember before New York got its act together again, and it was just, and it was sort of the perfect backdrop for the Son of Sam killings at the same time. And yet, even as you were telling the story of Maury Terry, this investigative journalist who was sort of self-trained investigative journalist, and his work on Son of Sam, I was reminded of so many things I had forgotten, including the number of people who had said early on, there's no way that this is just one guy.
That was a really interesting thing. You know, we had done a lot of research, and I had always heard, you know, delving into Maury's theory that Berkowitz didn't act alone. He had told me that there were whispers in the police precinct, in the Omega Squad at the time, which was this special unit that they had set up of over 300 detectives to try and find Berkowitz. And he said that some of the detectives, there was grumblings in that squad, basically, that Berkowitz didn't act alone. And finally, after years and years and years, I had spoken to some of the guys in the intelligence department of the NYPD, and they said, yeah, we actually did believe that Berkowitz didn't act alone. Not everybody, but there were definitely a core group of some who didn't believe that Berkowitz didn't act alone. You know, it was One guy just couldn't have done it. And yes, it does sound like a conspiracy theory, but, you know, Maury was right. Now, was Maury ever on Coast to Coast?
I don't know. That's a really good question. He wasn't on with me, and I've been associated with the show for a couple of decades. I should have looked that up because he would have been a natch for Coast to Coast. Yeah. You know, it's... You say conspiracy theory, and I just want to pause for a second, because I think what's so interesting about that is the difference between what Maury Terry, this guy who used to write for the IBM newsletter or whatever it was, and who became a journalist dedicated to becoming somebody who was going to uncover the truth behind this story. I was asked this the other day at a conference, and I say the difference is conspiracy theorists are people who never want to accept an explanation. They're only focused on the why or the what. They're only interested in the question, not the answer. And Maury Terry was totally focused on the answer. He just didn't like some of the answers that he was given, but he kept digging. He didn't just keep falling back. He really, even if it meant going to South Dakota or whatever, he was determined to try to firsthand do the legwork that was necessary to uncover whether or not it was true that David Berkowitz could have acted alone.
Well, you know, I'm if you've seen Cropsey and some of my other work, like Killer Legends, even I did a series called The Killing Season about the Long Island serial killer case.
Yes.
You know, I like to debunk conspiracy theories. I like to try and tell people the truth of what's really going on. And this was a case that was totally different than anything else I had ever seen. You know, I went in sitting down with Maury as a complete skeptic. I didn't believe it, to be honest with you. I liked the story. I thought it was really interesting, but I didn't believe it. And Maury was kind of so invested in making sure that everybody understood the truth that he kind of pushed people away rather than lulling them in. And, and maybe that was part of his downfall. So I was a skeptic, and he would go in and he would tell me these things, and I'd be like, I'm not so sure. And then he'd kind of shuffle off into his bedroom and come out with a piece of evidence, and it would blow my mind.
Right.
And that was what was really interesting. You know, it's almost like, what if there's a conspiracy theorist out there, but what if this one time it's right, you know, he's right.
It's well,
true.
That's what
I felt like I was dealing with.
And I think it's right. I think conspiracy theories, it doesn't take much to make a conspiracy. It's just more than one, right?
Right,
it's just two people coordinating. And so the question isn't so much to me whether or not there's a conspiracy involved. That's easy. The question, I mean, a guy getting his mother to cover for him to say where he was that night is a conspiracy by definition.
Sure. Right.
But beyond just conspiring with somebody, it was, as you mentioned, it was that satanic piece. That's the part that starts you right away, because we've been down that road, and every time some 13-year-old, you know, spray painted something on a garage door, everybody was looking for covens or whatever, and it was like that. Wait, ho. But this is one of those cases where it really seems to be the only explanation.
That's the whole thing. You know, I was walking in there believing it was satanic panic, you know, and I looked at a lot of those cases, like Ricky Casso, you know, on Long Island. You know, here's a kid, he kills another kid, and as he's killing him, he's stuffing rocks down his throat or something like that, and he's saying, "Say you love Satan, say you love Satan." And he kills this kid, and everybody's like, "Oh, that's a satanic crime." Not really. You know, this was just a kid who wore an AC/DC t-shirt and, you know, did a lot of drugs and kind of like to play that game. He's what, you know, they call a dabbler. This was really an actual true case. Now, what I mean by that is, was the devil real? No. But what we're talking about is a bunch of people, maybe three or four, maybe a little bit more, who were actually committing crimes, quote, in the devil's name. Now, was it just in the devil's name? No. There was some more financial motivations behind it, but they used the satanic part as a motivator. You know, what better way to convince people to commit crimes than giving it a religious background? And that is what I believe was part of it.
Yeah, well, it is also especially of that period, what better reason to get a bunch of people to get naked and run around the woods?
Of course.
Right?
I mean, I think a lot of it was sex, too, you know,
yeah.
And it was, you know, and I think that it was a great motivator to get people to commit these crimes. And, you know, chaos, you know, people do like chaos, like
they do.
Without a doubt. We can't deny that some people kind of are drawn to chaos and like to commit crimes in the name of chaos. But there's also other reasons behind it. Now, when Maury originally revealed to the world that he believed that there were other people involved, and he had a fair, really good amount of evidence to do that, the police called him a crackpot. And I think what happens is Maury kind of doubled down. Maury kind of spun out a little bit because the police kept calling him crazy.
Yeah, I think that in a way that was the play, right? It was to go ad hominem and to discredit him. Then they didn't have to worry about whatever he had to say. And what he had to say was a threat to their promotion. What he had to say was a threat to their success. What he had to say was, you know, sort of piqued a lot of the same old the police versus the press wars that have been going on. And I think again, to circle back a little bit, and we're talking with Joshua Zeman, the executive producer and director of The Sons of Sam, A Descent into Darkness, a big hit on Netflix, for it's not just because it's so challenging to watch, but because I do think there's a new generation of people who are not influenced by the original police investigation. And to them, they don't care what the police had to say in 1979. Doesn't bother them. And so they're looking at it completely fresh. And I think that's the success of a true crime doc like this, is it forces a reassessment that the press doesn't do well and the police are certainly not interested in.
That's very true. You know, a lot of Maury's kind of, he had a core group of people around him. And interestingly enough, they called themselves the Pine Street Irregulars.
Right.
After
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Yeah.
Irregulars. Yeah. And of course, Pine Street, where David Berkowitz lived. And for years, they have been trying to get this narrative out there that Berkowitz didn't act alone. And the world kind of ignored them. Partly because of Maury's kind of descent down the madness, down the rabbit hole a little bit towards the end of his life. And so they said to me, Josh, what makes you think you are going to be able to change the public's mind? And I said, you know what? Recently, what's been going on with the police, we now have a different viewpoint of the police. You know, we now, because of TV and because of video.
Body cams.
You know, yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's no longer just, you know, good guys, bad guys, white hats, black hats. You know, people understand that police investigations can now really be influenced by politics and things like that. And that's exactly what happened. You know, you were saying what a crazy time it was. It was a crazy time. I mean, you had New York City was on the verge of bankruptcy. You had fires, over 12,000 cases of arson. The Bronx was burning. You had a blackout, which caused millions of dollars worth of damage. You had police unions. Police were being laid off. You had sanitation workers being laid off. You had mountains of garbage in the street. Crime was an incredible high, 4 murders, 5 murders a night. And it was just an incredible time.
Right.
And basically, suddenly, on top of it, you have these murders. And you know, suddenly nobody's going out. They're not going to restaurants. They're not going to discos. They're not going to bars. The streets are empty, which kind of sounds familiar, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so the streets are empty. And suddenly out they catch this guy who says, "What took you so long?" David Berkowitz. And he's led in front of the cameras and he's smiling. And he says, "A dog commanded me to do it."
Right.
He was the perfect patsy. And he was exactly what Mayor Abe Beame and New York City needed. He was a sacrifice to allow them to kind of get back on their feet. So, and he admits it. He admits to doing all of it. Now, what's crazy is that the police did not do a very good, what's called post-arrest investigation. They didn't even interview John and Michael Carr, the two other real-life Sons of Sam.
I mean, yeah, they were.
How could they not do that? So it was an amazing time. And so you can understand in some respects if this guy, David Berkowitz, who's smiling for the cameras, who lives alone and he's a postal worker, it fits. So why keep pushing forward? But, you know, it's like Maury was always, he's like, I don't understand. I was like, Maury, come on. That's Chinatown, Jake.
Right. You know, exactly.
This is the big city. This is how things go.
Oh, and to reference another movie, it's the New York Police Department post Serpico, and it post that whole investigation in the early 70s, where this was their first chance to look like the heroes again. In a lot of ways, if they weren't wearing black hats, a lot of them were wearing gray hats. Anyway, all right, so this is where we'll pick it up. We're talking with Josh Zeman, the executive producer, the director of that new Netflix series about Sons of Sam, and I'm going to allow you to get into the conversation next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so we'll let you in a little bit here on the conversation with Joshua Zeman, at least toward the end of this hour, if you've got a good question, especially if you've watched the Netflix series Sons of Sam about the Maury Terry investigation and really Josh's work on top of that. So it's not just a recap of what Maury Terry did. It was following up on some of the leads that Maury Terry started, but in some ways didn't live long enough to really be able to verify. I think Josh makes a stronger case for Maury Terry's theories on the multiple sons of Sam than Maury Terry did. But you'll know better what I mean when you see the Netflix doc series. So worth it if you don't have Netflix. You heard that opening bumper. It gives you an idea of what the theme will be tonight for the bumpers. And we're looking forward to next hour's guest, a most remarkable creature, the hidden life and epic journey of the world's smartest birds of prey. We're talking about super big ones. We're talking about birds of prey that are prehistoric, that are essentially dinosaurs still walking amongst us. And our guest will explain why. That starts next hour. In the meantime, we'll pick up the conversation where we left it off. A diminutive mayor of New York, Mayor Abe Beame, who might as well have been the mayor of Munchkinland, a police department that was very proud of the fact that they had tripped fairly by accident into a conclusion for the Son of Sam killings. And then what was left over? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Joshua Zeman is the executive producer and the director, the writer of terrific docs. Go through the list. And I forgot about Killing Season, by the way. I want to tell you what I think you do right. Just like a footnote. You do something really well that not everybody does, and I think it separates you out from a lot of the crime porn that pretends to be true crime docs, is that you remain victim-centric.
It's important. You know, I think there is a lot of true crime porn out there. And, we can't lose sight of really what this is about, you know, and it's either finding justice or also giving those victims a voice. That's one of the things in the Sons of Sam case. There's a victim, Carl De Niro, who was shot, was a victim of the Son of Sam. You know, for years he tried to find out who really shot him. Berkowitz said that he wasn't the one that pulled the trigger. He went to the police. The police even kind of dismissed him. And so, you know, it was important for him for this series to get made. It's so funny because you say that every time I talk to him, and every time that Carl does one of these look back historical reviews of the Son of Sam, he goes, oh, they say the same old thing, the barking dog scenario. And he's like, when are people actually going to listen and actually going to get the story right? And so that was something that we really tried to do.
But it was also the Stacey Moskowitz piece of that, and other things. And I tell that to you from the, you actually even echoed what Anne Rule, the queen of true crime, told me when I interviewed her when I was working on my dissertation. And she said, real true crime must always be victim-centric. Everything else is just crime porn. And I thought there's a, that was such an interesting way of looking at it. And she said, I provide the voice for the dead. And the voice for the dead is always crying out for justice and also to be heard. Women, in her case, that she felt had been silenced. And it, and she was there to teach the living the lessons from the dead in true crime. And I thought, God, that's just brilliant. So love how you do that. And you do that. You've done that in everything I've ever seen you do. And I think that's what, I think that's what should give any victim's family confidence in talking to you.
Thank you.
I hope that's your experience. Yeah. So,
you know, one interesting anecdote to that story is when I did Cropsey, one of the parents said, okay, I'll speak to you, but please promise me that you're never going to do one of those serial killer docs. And I said, okay, you know, I promise I never will. And then when we did the killing season, which was about the Long Island serial killer, I had to kind of go back and say, look, I want to do this series because these women, you know, don't have a voice. The sex workers who didn't have justice. And, you know, she said, okay, fine. You know, you can do it now.
That's an interesting overlap to last night's conversation about Jack the Ripper, too. And I just want to, I think that's where, again, when you're talking about giving victims a voice, you aren't doing a... You aren't doing a serial killer doc. You're doing a serial killer victims doc. And that's what should make, I mean, that's definitely how my wife bought in. She ordinarily, she's kind of repulsed by things like that, but she was completely transfixed. That and the horrible fashion and hair decisions made by female reporters in the 1970s.
I think they're great. You know, honestly, that's part of the...
Come on. Come on. They look like either about to go to an aerobics class or they're just about to do a cameo on the Jetsons. I mean, it was like, what? There was no... The men are just wearing boring suits and ties, but the women, whatever, the headbands, that stuff is crazy.
Born in Brooklyn, no shirts at all.
Right, that's right. So, all right, so again, Josh Zeman, the new doc, Sons of Sam. What you set out to do was to pick up the fallen mantle of Maury Terry, this reporter, the self-proclaimed investigative reporter who proved himself, but then also became over-identified with his ideas. He lost that sliver of objectivity between his ideas and himself. And therefore, anybody that talked about his ideas, he felt, were really just talking about him. And that's how he ended up becoming so defensive before he was dead. And he lost friends and allies along the way.
Very much so. I think he fell down the rabbit hole of his own case,
yeah,
which is something that I think we all can understand, especially with the internet. We can all fall down that rabbit hole so easily. You know, part of the goal was to make a cautionary tale of true crime, especially considering what's going on today with all this proliferation of true crime. I mean, you have to understand that it's a dangerous world and there are consequences, and it's easy to get myopic. And I think part of the importance of true crime is listening to all sides as well.
Yeah. But I mean, I think in that way, true crime functions as our modern folk tales, and that it functions as what we used to have a lot of, was morality plays.
Yeah.
And it explained normative behavior. And when that true crime seems whack is when they focus on, and then this killer did this, and then he did that, and it's like, eh. So the idea, though, that this was a satanic cult, I mean, you have video, you have testimony, you have follow-up research, and you have a way of presenting the story in the sober fashion, which really does make the case for an international, or sorry, at least national, but if not international, and I think you make the case pretty effectively about the connection to England, giant underground dark family that may have even included Charles Manson. And even that seems crazy at first blush.
The Manson connections are interesting. But where I think Maury went wrong is somehow thinking that these were all connected, truly organized, because I think bad people manage to find each other in the darkness, stumbling through. Bad people gravitate. People who like to do kind of evil things gravitate towards each other. But I think Maury realized in the end that it wasn't an organized network. It wasn't connected. What it was is basically like any organization, like any religion. Typically, if you were to ask me the leaders of the process, they're fine. They had no idea. They were spiritualists. They had some crazy ideas born out of 1970s. But I don't think there was anything nefarious going on in the upper echelons of the process at all. What I think was, once the process broke up in New York City, there were one or two individuals who were trepidating on the dark side who then kind of went further. And that is where I think we broke from Maury's initial conclusions. Towards the end of his life, Maury started to realize, you know what, it wasn't some network. It was really, you know, a bunch of people who like to do bad things and kind of using the idea of Satanism as a moral cover or immoral cover, for example,
right,
for things that they like to do. But it wasn't, you know, this cabal of international satanic pedophiles. That's not what we're talking about here.
Right.
We're talking about a bunch of guys in Yonkers. And yes, you know, does a guy from Yonkers happen to go to California at the same time and maybe come back? Sure, one of them, two of them. But I really am hard-pressed to say whether it's some kind of organized network, and especially in the way in which people talk about organized networks today. No, that's not what was happening. You know what? It was more the mob than it was organized
right.
networks of Satanists.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. And I also, the only thing I would parse out of that is, by the end of it, the idea of a Manson connection doesn't seem so crazy. I mean, it's like Maury Terry made big claims, and then especially with the ending in mind, you go, okay, wait a second. He had that prediction right. What else could he have gotten right if he had lived long enough to investigate it?
Well, you know, the thing is, you know, the process, which is theoretically one of the organizations which we talk about, and, you know, the process disbanded from England. They went over to California, many other places too, but including California. And, you know, they went to Haight-Ashbury. Manson was hanging out in Haight-Ashbury. Manson probably went to one of their meetings. You know, they had a soup kitchen. He was interested in religious ideas. He went in there, heard something, and of course, what happens? Manson leaves and goes to start his own cult, you know, and kind of in the wrong hands, that's going to be very bad. His organization, which we know was called The Family, ironically, Berkowitz and his organization was called The Children, you know. So I also think that people who like to start, for lack of a better word in this case, cults, kind of have the same playbook.
And I think that playbook, the interesting connection for so much of that, oddly enough, again, comes back to the upper Midwest, in a place which you never would have suspected, but where the other people who are linked to the murders also frequented. Now, how weird is that? And so
totally
I don't want to give that any more of that away, because it was such a wonderful twist. And besides that, Dorothy wants to talk to you west of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. She lives on Murder Mountain. Dorothy, I don't know where Murder Mountain is. Explain that.
I do.
Didn't you do the documentary Murder Mountain?
I did. I also did Murder Mountain. And I have to say, I love Humboldt. I think Humboldt is an amazing place. I think Island Mountain, Alder Point, it's a great place.
You did the Murder Mountain documentary.
I did, that's correct.
But I was unfamiliar with it. So, Dorothy or Josh, fill me in on that.
I did a 6-part series that was also on Netflix about 2 years ago called Murder Mountain, which looked at the transition of the black market into the white market. and looked at used a kind of crime to explain the difficulties of transitioning, and that was the murder of Guerra Rodriguez and a number of individuals who lived up in that community who helped kind of try to bring that killer to justice.
Dorothy, you had a follow-up question for Josh?
Yeah. I was wondering, for the people who were victims or families of victims of the Son of Sam, this has got to be really difficult for them to think that there are other people, sons of Sam, still out there walking around that may have killed their loved one and, you know, have no repercussions. That's got to be disconcerting for them.
Maury Terry, as we were talking before about victims, he was very much into making sure that he pled his case about and brought his evidence to many of the victims, that being the Moskowitz family, and, of course, Carl DeNiro, who was one of the victims. And by the end of it, some of his biggest supporters were the victims' families. They realized after speaking to a number of police officers, and we're talking decorated NYPD, who said, you know what, I looked into this case as well. I found some incredible inconsistencies. I brought those to my superiors. They told me to shut the investigation down. So the families, or at least Carl and some of the others, some of them are actually very happy that finally this case is getting looked at with this eye. The question is, what's really going to happen? Is the NYPD going to reopen up the case? And that's not up to the NYPD. That's up to a district attorney. But there are people who are finally feeling that they're being heard, and that's important.
You know, one of those, whenever you put out a doc like this, I'm sure you get lots of interesting feedback and people who say, I just watched this and it jogged a memory, or I found, you know, as I sometimes describe it, as, you know, the shoeboxes full of evidence and dad's closet kind of a thing. And it's in those shoeboxes of history sometimes that things are revealed. And I'm sort of haunted by one thing. And that was the proposition that the murder of Stacey Moskowitz was filmed or videotaped, and that it was set up to be that in order to, you know, satisfy the bloodlust of one of those small groups of people that thought of themselves as Satan worshipers that were meeting out in the woods. Have you heard from anybody that can back up that story that the murder of Stacey Moskowitz was not done by David Berkowitz, but it would have been orchestrated by people who wanted to film a murder?
Yes, I heard from a member of law enforcement who said that they had in fact corroborated the existence of that tape. Now, also, anytime you're dealing with a criminal case and somebody says snuff film, you should immediately be skeptical. It's one of those unicorns like you were talking about.
Yeah.
And that should, you know, people like to throw around this term snuff film. And again, be skeptical anytime you hear it, because chances are it'll fall into this kind of BS satanic category.
Right.
Again, and this is what makes this case so interesting. As a skeptic, and I look at it, this is one case where this idea of a snuff film may actually be true. And if you speak to FBI agents like Kenneth Lanning, who is an unbelievable expert in this and helped to dispel the whole satanic panic myth, he says that such snuff films aren't real. But I've tried to convince him in this case that there is that. Now, is it a very good film? Meaning, like, was that really what was going on? Probably not. But yes, attempts were made to film it.
Okay. You know, there was a template once given to me by the original executive producer of the show, who once said to me, the best Coast to Coast shows start with everybody going, no way. And then by the end of it, before you go to bed, just before you turn off the light, when the show's over, you go, well, maybe. And I think that that's exactly the pattern that I experienced while watching I was reminded of how much guff Maury Terry had experienced and how many times I had seen him on shows and how I might, too, have been one of those viewers that after a while dismissed him. I'm glad you've resurrected the work. You resurrect him and keep him immortal in the meantime. Josh, I hope this is not the last time you will come and share some air with us. But I just want you to know I'm a big fan, and you'll always find a soft landing here on Coast to Coast, no matter what you're doing. Okay?
Take care. Bye.
Thank you so much. The Netflix series Sons of Sam, it's out. And if you're thinking about predators, if you're thinking about birds of prey, what an interesting transition into what's coming up next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.